We now present the Bible for Today of the Air, heard each week at the same time and over the same station at the Dean Bergant Society with International Studios at 900 Park Avenue, Collingswood, New Jersey. This is Dr. D.A. Waite, Director of the Bible for Today, speaking. Welcome to weekly broadcast number 841. 841 weeks of weekly broadcasting, standing together with the Dean Bergant Society in defense of traditional Bible texts, including the traditional Masoretic Hebrew Old Testament text, the traditional Greek New Testament text, and the Textus Receptus, which is the Greek text, and the King James Bible. We're building Bible confidence. Confidence in the King James Bible, because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. The order phone number is 1-800-JOHN-10-9. For other things, please call us on a question and answer phone, 856-854-4452, or email bft@biblefortoday.org. We'd like to hear from you. We'd like you to get our book called Defending the King James Bible. Now in its 8th printing, 350 pages, hardback edition. When it asks your bookstore to get Defending the King James Bible, or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Then have you ordered your defined King James Bible, published for the Bible for Today. Uncommon words in the King James are defined accurately in the footnotes. It's deluxe, genuine leather, Treasure 12-point large print, 10-point medium print, over 46,000 rand print, and distributed worldwide. Why not order yourself a copy and one for your friends? The defined King James Bible. Well, we're continuing this week in our study of A Guide to Textual Criticism of the New Testament by Edward Miller, an associate of Dean John William Bergon, written in 1868, along in there, 1888, I guess, 1886, 88, 1885. It's an old book, hardback edition, reprinted by the Dean Bergon Society, of which I've been president now for 25 years. It's yours. You can find out how to get it. We'll tell you how to get your copy by sending whatever it costs, and we'll let you know what that is. Just give us a call at 1-800-JOHN-10-9 and ask how you get number 743, but Miller's Guide to Textual Criticism of the New Testament. We don't agree with textual criticism. We believe that the King James Bible's Hebrew and Greek texts are solid, they're dependable, and they're accurate. We believe, I believe personally, that they're the very words that God has preserved for us from the original Hebrew and the original Greek. And our King James Bible has accurately translated those preserved Hebrew and Greek words into the English language, and we praise God for the King James Bible. Right, we're in chapter 3. Miller's chapter 3, the history of textual criticism, contemporary growth, talking about youth now, youth. He takes up, first of all, letter A under this chapter, Lachman. He's been talking about Lachman, and that's number one. And then number, it's a school of extreme textualism. These people are extremists. They're precursors. They're forerunners of Bishop Westcott and Professor Hort, who are apostate heretics theologically and certainly heretical as far as their Greek text is concerned. It's amazing to me how that these fundamentalist four institutions, the big four I call them, the fundamentalist friends who agree with us in fundamentalism and separation, but follow apostates like Westcott and Hort in their Greek text. It's amazing that Bob Jones University can follow apostates Westcott and Hort. Amazing that Detroit Baptist Seminary can follow that. That Central Baptist Seminary, that Calvary Baptist Seminary can follow these apostates with their worship and adoration of Manuscript B and the Vatican and Manuscript Aleph, the Sinai. Well, Lachman was a precursor of those that teach at Bob Jones and Detroit and Calvary and Central. A precursor, Lachman. He foreran and went before Westcott and Hort in their extreme textualism. And that's what we have in fundamentalist institutions. I cannot understand how fundamentalist groups and colleges and seminaries can go with extreme textualism. But that's exactly what Edward Miller calls it. That's what they believe. What about Lachman? After Lachman, he was an apostate himself, a German apostate from Berlin, and he was succeeded by Samuel Prideaux Tregellis, whose labors were much more prolific. Brought up, first of all, he was brought up amongst the Society of Friends, and as he was a Quaker to start with, he passed through the body of Plymouth Brethren, he was once a Plymouth Brother, into the position of a lay member of the Church of England. So Tregellis finally went into the Church of England. Now, the most important part of his work, reading from the book by Edward Miller, the Guide to the Textual Criticism of the New Testament, on page 22. And from the Church of England, the most important part of his work is to be found in his editions and especially his collations of manuscripts. Now, collations are comparing one manuscript with another. Very good on his collations of manuscripts. He edited two, that is Codex Zacynthius, which is Sigma, and also belonging to the British Reformed Bible Societies, I guess it's C is what it is, and the fragment O. He collated with great accuracy 18 uncials, those are capital letter manuscripts, and 13 cursives, those are flowing hand manuscripts in the Greek text. So he collated many manuscripts. And he devoted much attention to versions and fathers, that is, these church fathers, especially to Origen and Eusebius. Well, Origen was a heretic. He shouldn't have made too much attention to that particular church father. Let me continue. Miller says, he discussed, that is, Tregellis discussed Lachmann's method in his account of the printed text of the New Testament and accepted unreservedly the first principle. Now, to Lachmann must be conceded this, that he led the way in casting aside the so-called Textus Receptus. Now, that, my friends, is the error of Lachmann. That, my friends, is the error of Tregellis and all these early textual critics. It's the error also of Griesbach. It's the error also of Westcott and Hort. And it's the error of teachers at Bob Jones University, the teachers at Detroit Baptist Seminary, teachers at Calvary Baptist Seminary and Central Baptist Seminary, fundamentalist schools, as well as myriads of new evangelical schools, such as my own school, my alma mater, Dallas Theological Seminary, from which I got the Master of Theology and the Doctor of Theology. I had new evangelical schools that follow Dallas, the false text, throwing away the text of Receptus. And this is true, of course, of the liberal apostate schools. All the apostate schools and the seminaries, if they ever teach Greek, they follow the Westcott and Hort type of text and throw out the text of Receptus. That's also true of the schools of Roman Catholicism. Roman Catholic colleges and seminaries, if they teach Greek at all, they follow the throwing out of the Textus Receptus that underlies our King James Bible. And I'm opposed to throwing out our Textus Receptus. I'm opposed to Tregellis. I don't care if he was a friend to start with, Society of Friends, and with the Plymouth Brethren, and then in the Church of England. The first principle he agreed with that heretic Lachmann was throw out, casting aside, the so-called Textus Receptus. Let me continue. Miller says, and boldly, placing the New Testament wholly and entirely on the basis of actual authority. With this disregard, utter disregard of the received text, Tregellis went on to the endorsement of the next principle. That is the next principle of Lachmann. First principle, throw out the text Receptus on which our King James Bible is based. Went on to the second principle, which was found in drawing a line of demarcation between the critical aids that are to be neglected as valueless and those upon which dependence was to be placed. He divided manuscripts into three classes. The ascent of those which were anterior to the 7th century was held by him to be essential for the settlement of any reading. Just pause right here. First of all, the three classes. Dean Burgon did not believe that there were three classes or families. In fact, Westcott and Hort invented a fourth family. The three families, the four families, they're not families. The manuscripts are orphan children, as Dean Burgon often would say. That's the first thing. He wanted to divide them in classes. Then he said, throw out anything that's anterior, except that which is anterior or before the 7th century, was held by him to be essential. Anything before the 7th century was essential. In other words, the later and more recent documents, throw them out. Let me continue. We don't agree with that. Now, he says, Edward Miller says, the cursives, that is the flowing hand manuscripts, dating since the 10th century, were erroneously regarded by him, by Tregellis, as in general opposed to the ancient copies. And the later uncials, between the 7th and 11th centuries, appeared to him to be divided in their agreement between the modern and the ancient. so that the only trustworthy authorities were the oldest of these. So here's your worship of the older manuscripts saying that they're the best. My friends, they would be closer to the originals, that is true, but the fact is they were absolutely corrupted by early heretics that operated in the churches, especially the churches in Egypt. And Egypt is where B and Aleph originated. The Vatican Sinai manuscripts originated in the land of Egypt, where sects and cults and false versions, false theologies prevailed. And that's where the danger came. So corrupted old manuscripts are far worse than pure, clean, later manuscripts, those have been copied and recopied because the original copies of these manuscripts have been thrown away. Even though they've been copied and recopied, the more recent ones that are pure and clean and uncorrupted by the heretics are far more dependable than those old manuscripts like B and Aleph, Vatican and Sinai, that have been corrupted by the heretics of Egypt. Let me continue. In a similar spirit, he that is Tregellis, this man who used to be a Plymouth Brethren and then a Church of England, he attended to none but the earliest versions, and to those sparingly, and cited no fathers later than Eusebius in the early half of the 4th century. So he used the versions, the early translations in other languages, sparingly, and no fathers later than Eusebius in the early half of the 4th century. Now the reasons for this latter limit are, number one, because Eusebius is in the line of demarcation between the earlier text and that which afterwards became widely diffused. And number two, the second reason, because of the absolute necessity of confining such an examination between such limits as it might be practicable for one individual to reach in any moderate number of years. Tregellis died in 1875 before his Greek Testament was fully out. 1875. Dean Burgon died in 1888. Gives you some idea of who was there, who wasn't there. So he died there in 1875. All right, number three. In the youth of this textual criticism, Edward Miller says this: but the most conspicuous figure in this school was Constantine Tischendorf. This is the extreme textualism school, followed by our fundamentalist friends, the four of them. The schools like Bob Jones University, Detroit Baptist Seminary, Calvary Baptist Seminary, Central Baptist Seminary, these schools follow the false texts that are worshipped by these men, Griesbach, Lachmann, Tregellis, and now Tischendorf. They follow blindly. They follow erroneously the false texts of B, the Vatican, and Aleph, the Sinai. They throw out the Textus Receptus on which our King James Bible has been based, regardless of the fact that over 99% of the manuscripts we now have are Textus Receptus type of manuscripts. They don't care. They only have less than 1% being out of 45 manuscripts is all they have. Less than 1% of the evidence. Well, here's this most conspicuous figure in the school was Constantine Tischendorf, a man of the most remarkable energy and success, who in the services that he rendered in assembling materials for textual criticism and in presenting them for employment to establish the genuineness of any reading, has outtopped even the most considerable figures in the long line of his predecessors. In other words, this man was a man of work, a man of labor. We don't agree with him. We don't believe his labors are correct, but he certainly labored long. He outtopped the most considerable figures of his predecessors. Edward Miller continues, the 8th edition of his Greek Testament is an amazing monument of the incessant toil which occupied a life that ended in December 7th, 1874. Now remember, Tregellis died in 1875, and Tischendorf died in 1874, 1 year earlier, shortly before the completion of his 60th year. He was 60 years of age, almost completing, almost 70. A record of his contributions to the critical age, to textual criticism, has been given by Dr. Caspar René Gregory, who, with some assistance from Professor Ezra Abbott, has written the first part of the Prolegomena, or the introduction to Tischendorf's Greek Testament. Tischendorf discovered 15 uncials, including the great Sinaitic manuscript Aleph, besides using for the first time 23. He edited 21, copied out 4, collated 13, that is, compared one with another, not to reckon much labor spent upon more than 30 others, and a toil of a smaller kind that is scarce recorded, of a smaller kind. So this toil was tremendous. This toil of Tischendorf was gigantic. Notice one of the uncials or capital letter manuscripts he found was the Sinaitic manuscript or Aleph. Now let's continue. Miller says this, we're on page 24 of, you've got to get this book, A Guide to the Textual Criticism of the New Testament. You may not agree with the textual criticism. I don't agree with this. These men that have gotten false theories of it. But you should have a brief guide, a brief series and synopsis to get you what the true methods are, such as were used by Edward Miller and Dean John William Burgon, rather than the apostates Westcott and Hort. We're on page number 24. He says, in the year 1844, while Tischendorf was traveling under the patronage of Frederick Augustus, King of Saxony, in quest of manuscripts, Tischendorf reached the convent of St. Catherine on Mount Sinai. Now, this is Mount Sinai in Egypt, convent of St. Catherine. Here, observing some old-looking documents in a basket full of papers ready for lighting the stove. Now, some have disputed the fact that these papers were getting ready to be burned. James White, for example, when I was debating him, 3 hours of debate, which is on the internet, that debate would be had, he disputed that. He disputed in his book that these were for lighting the stove. He didn't agree with that at all. But this is what Edward Miller has. I'm sure his research has been accurate. Papers ready for lighting the stove. He picked them out and discovered that there were 43 vellum leaves, vellum, a form of leather, vellum leaves of the Septuagint version. So here's the LXX Septuagint, which we don't believe is accurate at all. We believe it's like a sham. Not to use it for any purposes. Never supersedes the Hebrew, the Masoretic traditional Hebrew text. But he found 43 vellum leaves of the Septuagint. He was allowed to take these. But in the desire of saving the other parts of the manuscript of which he heard, he explained their value to the monks, who, being now enlightened, would only allow him to copy one page and refused to sell him the rest. On his return, that is when Tischendorf returned, he published in 1846 what he had succeeded in getting under the title of Codex Frederico Augustanus, inscribed to his benefactor. He's the one that gave him the money. In 1859, he was again in the East, being sent by Alexander II, Emperor of Russia, and was received at the convent, that is, the convent of St. Catherine on Mount Sinai, as an emissary from the great protector of the Eastern Church. One night, in a conversation with the steward, he was shown a manuscript written on loose leaves and wrapped in a red cloth, and was allowed to examine it. He sat up all night with his treasure, for as he said, it seemed wicked to sleep. He found a complete New Testament, a large portion of the Septuagint, the Epistle of Barnabas, and a fragment of the Sephora of Hermas. Those last two books, of course, are in the apocryphal books, doubtful books, not scripture. After this, he was allowed to copy the manuscript, and the codex was in course of time presented to the emperor, and now is in St. Petersburg. Apparently, this is Codex Aleph. We're not told specifically, but if he found some of the documents in 1844 and went back and was allowed to take them in 1859, that would be a total of 15 years later, and so he named it, and these documents are in St. Petersburg at this time, Russian St. Petersburg. Now he goes on, Edward Miller goes on, before the discovery of this important manuscript, Tischendorf had issued 7 editions of his Greek Testament. In these, as far as the third, he had paid scarcely any attention to the cursive copies, that is, these flowing hand manuscripts. Now notice, this is a man, Tischendorf, a scholar, no question about that. Very laborious, no question about that. He went to the bottom of things. He went to the sources of things. He copied many manuscripts, collated many manuscripts. He was a diligent man. But he had made 7 Greek New Testaments, 7 editions. And when he found this Sinai manuscript, he said that these editions are based on the best possible sources. When he found this manuscript, Aleph, the Sinai manuscript, he practically threw out all of his first 7 editions and almost started from scratch, using just this one manuscript. Let me continue the way Edward Miller portrays it. In these, that is, these 7 editions, Tischendorf's 7 editions of the Greek New Testament, so far as the 3rd, he had paid scarcely any attention to the cursive copies. After that edition, the course of his studies led him to introduce their record into the lists of authorities on passages. In other words, he then began to use the cursive copies. The consequence was that his 7th edition has been calculated to differ from the 3rd in 1,296 instances. So he certainly changed many passages because of this discovery of Sinai or the Aleph manuscript. In no less than 595 of which, 430 of the remainder being mere matters of spelling, he returned to the readings of the Textus Receptus, or received text, which he had before deserted. Now notice this. He returned 595 readings of his changes, 1,296 changes, 595 readings back to the received text, which underlies the King James Bible, good for him, which he had before discarded and deserted, but to which fresh materials and larger experience had brought him back. Well, my friend, he should have been back to start with. He should never have left the Textus Receptus. My friend, if you're listening to me and you're confused about what text to use of the Greek New Testament that underlies our New Testament books, you should study, you should look, you should read, and you should discard the false information that you've been receiving, if you've been receiving it from the Westcott and Hort critical text side of things. You should throw it away. He never should have left the Textus Receptus. Tischendorf shouldn't have left it. Tregellis shouldn't have left it. Griesbach shouldn't have left it. Any of these men should not have left it. Certainly Lachmann, as well as this man Tischendorf himself. The 8th edition was constructed with the help of his newly discovered Sinaitic manuscript, Aleph, and his attachment to the treasure that he had rescued proved too much for him. And notice, he altered his 7th edition in no less than 3,369 instances. I'll just wait right there. Here's a man that compared all these different texts and early ones and late ones and so on. He had it made. 7 editions of the Greek New Testament Tischendorf had made, and suddenly discovering this one manuscript in a wastebasket that the monks of the monastery and convent of St. Catherine were about to destroy in the flame in order to heat up the oven, lighting the stove. He takes this one manuscript and makes 3,369 instances of change, generally in compliance with the Sinaitic copy, the Aleph copy, to the scandal, as Dr. Scrivener justly remarks, of the science of comparative criticism, as well as to his own grave discredit for discernment and accuracy. So he was unjust, Dr. Scrivener says. Dr. Frederick Scrivener was a tremendous scholar in the Greek language and an Anglican Church of England man, while on the Revision Committee of the King James, the English Revised Version of 1881. Let me continue. Miller says, "Much, therefore, as we may and must ever feel indebted to Tischendorf for the invaluable results of his labors, we cannot regard him as a man of sober and solid judgment. His zigzag course," that's what Miller calls it, "his zigzag course does not impress us with the soundness of any position upon which he found himself throughout it." So that's Tischendorf, Constantine Tischendorf. Let's move on to number 4 in this chapter of Miller's Guide to Textual Criticism, chapter 3, the youth of this textual criticism history. He says this: but the principles of the school of textualists, this extreme school, have reached their most emphatic and complete exposition in the introduction to the Greek Testament, edited by Professors Westcott and Hort. Now, this introduction to the Greek New Testament has been reproduced by the Bible for Today. It's hard to get. Maybe you can find a used copy here and there, but it's out of print many years now. But we reprinted it for the very simple reason that Dean Burgon has answered this terrible, terrible introduction to the Greek New Testament in the book called Revision Revised. We published that too. We republished that and reprinted that. But this introduction by Westcott and Hort, mostly Hort, is a terrible thing. We've reprinted it so you could read it for yourself without any additions or subtractions being made in it, as was questioned and was planned, we understand, by some. Let me continue. This edition, that is, Introduction to the Greek Testament, was founded upon labor in the case of both these erudite men, that is, Westcott and Hort, extending through nearly 30 years, including the period when, as revisers, they were assisting in the revision of the English translation. Now notice, for 30 years, Bishop Westcott, Professor Hort, had worked on this Greek manuscript. It's a fresh Greek manuscript. It follows basically and almost exclusively manuscript B, the Vatican, and manuscript Aleph, the Sinai. For 30 years, they did not pop it on anybody until about 1880. So 1850 to 1880, roughly, 30 years, they'd been working on this scheme. And in 1881, they used their text basically as the basis of the English Revised Version that changes and alters our King James Bible in many places. All right, so this is what they did. He had the English translation, the Westcott and Hort, and this introduction in 1881 or thereabouts was a terrible thing indeed. Then Miller goes on and says, copies were, however, printed privately and placed in the hands of all the revisers. Now, I want you to remember, they said you cannot tell anybody about this Greek text. It must be absolutely sacrosanct. It must be secret, because we don't want anyone to know of our intentions. You can't release this text until after the English Revised Version of 1881 has been produced and gotten out to the public. So that's what they did. It was not till the revision was out that they became public property, that is, these revisions and the committee of it that we have. It did not come out until it was made public. Then and only then could they release their Greek text. And shortly afterwards, an elaborate and ingenious introduction was published from the hand, as is stated, by Dr. Hort. So Hort is the one that basically did the job of the introduction of the Greek New Testament. Well, time's up for now. Remember the words of our Lord Jesus Christ in John 10:9. He said, I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, shall go in and out, and find pasture. Write us. Bible for Today, Collingswood, New Jersey. Or call us on the order phone, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Ask your bookstore for Defending the King James Bible and the Defined King James Bible. Or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Dr. D.A. Waite, signing off and reminding you, you can have confidence in the King James Bible because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. We hope you'll turn in next time and same station, to hear us continuing. We're going to continue in Edward Miller's excellent book, hardback edition, reprint. It's enlarged from the original, A Guide to the Textual Criticism of the New Testament. It's republished and reprinted by Dean Burgon Society, number 743, hardback edition. You ought to get it for yourself, your pastor, your friends. It gives a history of this terrible thing. We don't agree with this textual criticism business, but gives a history, the things that are good with it, things that are bad with it, and it certainly exposes the falsities of Bishop Westcott and Professor Hort and those like him. So stay tuned. See you next time, same station. Until then, so long. We now present the Bible for Today of the Air. Heard each week at the same time and over the same station, sponsored by the Bible for Today Incorporated and the Dean Burgon Society, with International Studios at 900 Park Avenue, Collingswood, New Jersey. This is Dr. D.A. Waite, Director of the Bible for Today, speaking. Welcome to weekly broadcast number 842. 842 weeks of weekly broadcasting, standing together with the Dean Burgon Society in defense of traditional Bible texts, including the traditional Masoretic Hebrew Old Testament text, the traditional received Greek New Testament text, and the traditional English text, the King James Bible. We're building Bible confidence. Confidence in the King James Bible, because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. The order phone number is 1-800-JOHN-10-9. For other things, please call us on a question and answer phone, 856-854-4452, or email bft@bibleforttoday.org. We'd like to hear from you. We'd like you to get our book called Defending the King James Bible. Now in its eighth printing, 350 pages, hardback edition. Why not ask your bookstore to get Defending the King James Bible, or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Then have you ordered your Defined King James Bible, published for the Bible for the day? Uncommon words in the King James are defined accurately in the footnotes. It's deluxe, genuine leather, not another Bible like it in the world. Choice of 12-point large print, 10-point medium print. Over 46,000 are in print and distributed worldwide. Why not order yourself a copy and one for your friends? While we're continuing this book, A Guide to the Textual Criticism of the New Testament, a brief book by Edward Miller, the associate of Dean John William Burgon, an understudy and a helper for him. The book came out in about 1886, 1885, in that neighborhood, and reprinted by the Dean Burgon Society just recently this past year. You got to get a copy of it. Call us and we'll tell you how to get it. 1-800-JOHN-10-9. All right, we continue in the youth of this movement, the Textual Criticism and its Youth, Chapter 3 of Edward Miller's book. We've gone through Griesbach, we've gone through Lachman and Fregelis, Titchendorf. Now we're at Westcott and Hort, those that are most recent, and those who people of the wrong kind of people, I should say, as far as their belief in the Bible, the wrong kind of people follow and accept and adopt. Westcott and Hort, Bishop Westcott and Professor Hort. Right on page 26 of the book, and Miller says this: the object of the introduction, that is, the introduction of the Greek New Testament by, mostly written by Hort, before the production and preparation of the English Revised Version of 1881. The object of the introduction is evidently to reduce to a definite system the principles of Lachman and to advance grounds upon which the testimony of a few authorities standing by themselves may be accepted in preference to the verdict of the great majority of witnesses. In other words, he's got to prove how a few copies can be materially superior and superior of quality to the vast majority of manuscripts. You've got to show that. But these people are not enlightened, but in the dark about this thing, seems like to me, and they throw out the majority of witnesses. Over 99% of the evidence thrown out. Oh, they have their reasons for it. We don't agree with the reasons. We believe they're false reasons. Miller continues: accordingly, it is argued that a text which is found in the 10th century, although it was rejected and lay in all but oblivion throughout the surrounding ages, is the genuine form and therefore must be followed. This doctrine leads to the exhibition of B and Aleph, but especially B, an exaltation of it. In other words, when you say that you're going to go through the succeeding ages and you've got to pick the oldest in the 4th century, you're leading up to B and Aleph, and that's the one that wins the prize. They win the treasure. And it's such a unique position that after an examination of these principles and their application, an observer unacquainted with the history of manuscripts would imagine that these two very far surpassed all others, both in antiquity and in an indisputable purity of expression. My friend, this purity of expression is not there. The purity of expression simply is not there as far as the Westcott and Hort text, Biff, B, and Aleph. But it goes on and says, indeed, an attempt is made based upon a large amount of speculation, but the very slenderest degree of evidence, to add a couple of centuries to their virtual age, that is, to the age of B and Aleph. Speculation. That's what Westcott and Hort thrive on. Speculation. That's what our friends from the fundamentalist schools that we've talked about many times on the broadcast, that's what they go on. Speculation. Bob Jones University Greek Department goes on speculation as far as this Westcott and Hort theory and the B and Aleph texts. Detroit Baptist Seminary, the same. Calvary Baptist Seminary, Central Baptist Seminary go on speculation rather than proof and documentation. This whole introduction by Hort, Professor Hort, written after the 1881 edition of the English Revised Version and after their Greek text was made public, this whole introduction is based principally on Hort's speculation, not on facts, just simply hypotheses and guesswork. That's the basis of those that hold to the false Westcott and Hort textual theory and text. Well, Miller goes on. He says, but it must ever be remembered that A and C are nearly as ancient as B and Aleph, Vatican and Sinai. Indeed, one opinion makes A, that is the Alexandrinus, only about 50 years younger than B, the oldest of the pair. Besides which, according to dates now admitted, B and probably Aleph were produced under the dark gloom of Asian ascendancy. A and C, in the light of this most intellectual period of the earlier church, A and C, that's when they came out. This deference to B, and that's what it is, it's a deference, amounting almost to a superstitious adulation, leads the two learned professors to follow it whenever it is supported by only slight testimony from other quarters. Now, that's an important statement, my friend. Do you realize that this deference, this siding with B, the Vatican manuscript, amounts to almost superstitious adulation? That means worship. Worship of a manuscript that was originated in Egypt and the cesspool of Egyptian heresies. Some 10 or 11 different cults and heretic groups, as even Bruce Metzger says, were founded in the 2nd century and before, were found in Egypt. And Bruce Metzger says, I don't even know any person, any group in Egypt in the 2nd century that you could call Orthodox. Permeated with heterodoxy, falsities, apostasy, heresies. That's the milieu. That's the background from which the B and Aleph manuscripts, Vatican Sinai, were dug and were dragged out. They were exhumed from a terrible, terrible burial in apostasy. Burial in apostasy by Bishop Westcott and Professor Hort. Exhumed, taken out, lifted up, and said, these be thy gods that brought thee out of the land of Egypt, as it were, lifted up by Westcott and Hort, throwing away the testimony, united testimony, of almost 1,500 years of the church that had accepted the traditional received text. That's received by all, as was in the 1633 preface. Received by all. Of course, of the version in the Greek text that had that. Can we continue? Edward Miller says, thus, speaking of this adulation, superstitious adulation, I might say this. When I debated James White, a three-hour radio debate many years ago, when I pointed out that heresies and heretics and apostates had doctored and changed and perverted the Greek New Testament words, James White said, oh, that's not true. That's absolutely false. And I listed about 10 or 12 different early heretics that talked about perverting the scriptures, that praised the perverting and changing of scriptures. He said, oh, that's terrible. I said, they almost worship it. Well, that's exactly what Edward Miller says. The worship is almost like a superstitious adulation of these two documents. And that led the two learned professors to follow whenever supported only by light testimony from other quarters. We continue. Miller says, thus they adopt all the readings already enumerated in the introduction to this little treatise, and a vast number of others as well. Same kind, but others. You know, we've we've mentioned these others in the earlier chapters. We've mentioned the different things that they have used in the treatise. They've changed different verses and changed different words. In the very first part of this, you ought to get that and see what it is. There are A, B, C, D, E, F, G, down to G. There's at least seven different changes, like in the last 12 verses of Mark, and the Lord's Prayer in Luke 11, 2-4, the doxology in Matthew 6, verse 13, as far as the bloody sweat and so on in the garden, that would be Luke, actually verses 43-44, and the chapter of Luke that deals with that. The first of the Lord's seven sayings from the cross, Luke 23:34, Father, forgive them, they know what they do. That's gone. That's a question. And then Luke's assertion of the ascension into heaven. And Luke 24 and verse 15 is questioned. And then Luke's recital of the institution of the Holy Sacrament of the Lord's table. So these things we've shown before have been followed in this little treatise and changed because of a worship, an adulation, a superstitious adulation, by Westcott and by Hort. Two Anglican Church of England men living in the 1800s, 1880s, 1890s, along in there, 1850s, the same era that Dean Bergon lived. He also was a Church of England man, but he was a conservative Church of England man. He was a fundamental man, and we praise God for him. All right, let's continue. For example, says Edward Miller, we're on page number 27 now. For example, they, that is Westcott and Hort, make Mark declare that the dancing girl who demanded the head of John the Baptist was Herod Antipas' own daughter, and that her name was Herodias, in flat contradiction to the account in Matthew as edited by themselves, and at variance also with the history represented by them in Luke. So he changes this thing, the dancing girl changes how to Herodias, contradicts the account of Matthew as edited by themselves, at variance also with the history of the family as given by Josephus. So he's completely changing it because they follow Westcott and Hort. Again, the Lord is represented by them, that is Westcott and Hort, in Luke as preaching in the synagogues of Judea at the very time which he is said by Matthew and Mark to have spent in doing the same in the synagogue of Galilee, and when he ought to have been in the latter part of the Holy Land, according to the critical passage itself. Also in Acts chapter 10 and verse 19, the Holy Spirit is described as telling Peter that two men were seeking him, when the seventh verse had made it clear that these were three, namely, two of Cornelius' servants and a soldier who was the constant attendant. And then in Acts 12, and verse 25, Paul and Barnabas are said to have returned from Jerusalem to Jerusalem. Now that's a Westcott and Hort reading, when they were really going back from Jerusalem to Antioch. Lastly, not to make the specimen and specific instances too numerous, the professors, that is Westcott and Hort, omit, and the revisers too, the precious verse of Matthew 17:21, which declares that this kind goeth not out, but by prayer and fasting. They omit that verse. Notwithstanding that only three manuscripts, B and Aleph and 33, testify by themselves for the omission against it, a very host of varied witnesses. And so they throw it out no matter how many they have as a host of witnesses to the contrary. They don't care. They worship manuscript B. And if manuscript B lines up with manuscript Aleph, then that's what to worship. But they're going after mostly over after B. They continue. Miller says this. This servile submission to B, in the face of copious testimony, may be also seen in the presentment of proper names, such as methylene for Melita. Evidently, a manuscriptional blunder, transcriptional blunder rather, of Nazareth in two places, only for Nazareth. Beelzebub, for instance, for Beelzebul. James for Joannes. The uncouth trunks, Comb and Gorgoth. And also a transcriptional mistake, the singular appellative Titus Justus, which is not the right one. They have also, this is Westcott and Hort, with more reason and authority on their side. They have, but with needless eccentricity, they've changed the order of books, placing the Catholic epistles before those of Paul. So they take, starting with Matthew, with Peter, 1st and 2nd Peter, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and so on. And they take that and make it in a separate place, different from where it should be. Mr. Miller continues, and he says, to such results as these professors Westcott and Hort have been guided in obedience to inescapable theory, nevertheless, they have here and there sacrificed their consistency to some extent. As, for example, when they have shrunk from disfiguring Paul's exquisite description of charity by the assertion that charity seeketh not that which is not her own, and therefore that she adds to numerous sublime traits of freedom from gross violations of this 8th and 10th commandments. In other words, they mistranslate seeketh not what is not her own, instead of seeketh not her own. But this fitful courage does not keep them from admitting that such a bathos in this at this might possibly not have offended the inspired taste of Paul, inasmuch as they have placed in their margin the stupid blunder of the scribe of B. And so this is what they've done. They violate the 8th and 10th commandment by taking away charity here. The theory of the Cambridge professors, those are Westcott and Hort, that leads to such results will be explained and sifted in the next chapter. But one feature in it must be noticed here. The authors adduce the slenderest support from textual evidence. Notice, the slenderest support. They don't care what the texts say, what the manuscripts say. That's not their idea. They have fixed upon one manuscript, B, the Vatican. They say that's the way to go. They say that's what we're going to take. That's what we're going to go with. And this is bad. They've shifted from the support of actual evidence to simply the slenderest support of evidence. Now, ingenious as it is, their course of reasoning is entirely destitute of historical foundation. It's not, of course, entirely destitute of historical foundation. You've got to have historical foundation in order to reason. You ought to have facts. Dr. Hort gives no array of authorities in text or notes and does not build up his theory upon acknowledged or produced facts. Let me just pause there and simply say, Hort, Professor Hort, does not base himself in facts. He lounges around in theory. He lounges around and stays in what he calls hypotheses, guesswork, not facts. Miller continues, the system thus unfolded, that is by Westcott and Hort, has derived greater prominence from its having been mainly adopted by two members of the New Testament Company in their defense of the received Greek text, or revisers rather, Greek text. So that's what the popularity is. They've rejected the text receptus, Westcott and Hort have, and they have accepted the so-called revisers Greek text. No one can read more, no one can read their pamphlet or examine the readings admitted by a majority of the revisers and defended by them, that is, Westcott and Hort, without seeing that although their action is in some respects independent of Drs. Westcott and Hort, they generally upheld the principles advocated by these learned men. What he's saying here is the English Revised Version Committee that finished their work in the New Testament in 1881, practically in every turn of the way, followed the suggestions and the text of Westcott and Hort. They didn't follow in every respect because they didn't know too much about it, but they followed in the main throughout. We continue. Miller says, indeed, alterations depending only upon B and Aleph, and sometimes upon B alone with some other support, are frequently preferred in the Revised Version before readings of the Textus Receptus, notwithstanding that the latter are so numerously and strongly attested. That on these cases, and on no other grounds, rather, except extreme deference to these uncials, that is, B and Aleph, could such a verdict be rejected. In other words, they threw away the Textus Receptus. They strongly said, we don't want it. We follow these two old uncials, B and Aleph, and that's what they're going to be doing the rest of their life. And they pushed those B and Aleph manuscripts, the false manuscripts, the critical text, on the present Greek text as well. They were instrumental in it, even though they were dead at the time that some of these new versions came out. Let me continue. Miller says, the championship and support of men so learned and illustrious must carry great margin. Great weight. The weight that's carried is a wrong weight, but they carry it anyway, even though it's supposition and hypothesis. And the question arises whether it be not so strong as to lead all who admire their great qualities to abide by their conclusions. My friend, they are so bamboozling. Bishop Westcott and Professor Hort are so bamboozling, so confusing, so confuted and confusing and discombobulated that people adore them. They follow them. They worship them. They read the introduction of the New Testament by Hort and Westcott. They think it's great. And they follow these learned men because of the ingenuity of the false hypothesis that's made in this introduction of the Greek New Testament by Hort. It's ingenious. It's false, but it's ingenious. Let me continue. Miller says, or is it possible that as the history of much human opinion, in the history of much human opinion, even that they may have been induced to take a wrong turn in early days, and that they have been led into a valley attractive in itself, but whence the best views have been excluded? End of quote. He's saying maybe they did this human opinion when they were earlier in their lives and never wanted to change. Took a turn in the early days, he says, but they've been led into a valley of attractive in itself, but the best views have been excluded. So he wonders, is this an early thing and they never changed? That's possible. Miller says, strange as such a conclusion might seem, the results of present inquiry seem to point imperatively in no other direction. And such is the contention of men quite as eminent in this particular province as the upholders of the opinions just subscribed and described. Well, this is the weight of the argument. Westcott and Hort want B and Aleph and the ancient manuscripts to maintain their force and their pressure and their support by those of us who are in the New Testament field. They don't always have facts behind it, but that's the way it is. All right, there's a new section now, section number 4. We're in chapter 3 of the Signs of Coming Maturity. That's the next section here, chapter 4, which is the idea of early Christian growth and of Christian different men, different kind of modernistic Christians, of course, but the growth and the change in the infancy of textual criticism, and the youth, it should say, the youth of textual criticism. So this division, number 4, Signs of Coming Maturity. Miller says this, textual criticism would not be governed by the principles that underlie all movements of human thought if the strenuous pursuance of so limited a course as the one recently followed did not provoke a departure in another direction. Now, what he's saying is this is a limited course that they've followed, but there's a departure in other directions as well as changing the text of Scripture in all these times, in the New Testament Greek. Miller continues, accordingly, strong opposition was made within the Revisers' Company by a stout minority headed by Dr. Scribner, the first textual critic of his day, and tacitly supported by members of the company who had ceased to act, as well as by other deep students of the subject, such as Dean Burgon and Canon Cook. In other words, the Revisers of 1881 went roughshod over Dr. Frederick Scrivener and others in their telling what should be the Greek text and what should not. There was a minority, but it was a stout minority, headed by Dr. Scrivener and some of the others, but they went roughshod over them in the committee of 1881, the English Revised Version, and followed mostly the Westcott and Hort false Greek text when it differed from the text Receptus received text that underlies our King James Bible. Let me continue, Miller says, and their advocacy has been developed into the teaching of a rival and rising school under which the basis is widened and the building is being constructed out of all the materials within reach. So here now, Westcott and Hort have begun the new school. And this is what he's going to talk about in this section, signs of coming maturity. He's got several divisions here. We're on division number one now of this. But they're building a building that's on the wrong structure based on Westcott and Hort's falsity. All right, continues. The first section here under the signs of coming maturity, the labor spent by Dr. Scrivener upon textual criticism is well known from his admirable introduction to the science. It's a handbook which leaves hardly anything, if anything, to be desired. Talking about the plain introduction to the criticism of the New Testament by Frederick Scrivener, we've reprinted that, we have it and available if you're interested. Dr. Scrivener's candor and patient and conscientious consideration of every point that presents itself and of every opinion resting upon intelligence and conspicuous in all that he has written upon the subject. And his accuracy, a matter of extreme importance in these matters, stands at the very top of editorial and collateral work. So this is one of the realms that opposed Westcott and Hort in the English Revised Version Committee as they met, and that is the coming maturity as Dean John Burgon is one of the ones, and of course Dr. Frederick Scrivener as well. He's written an excellent book, Plain Introduction to the Greek New Testament. Well, time's up for now. Remember the words of our Lord Jesus Christ in John 10:9. He said, I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out and find pasture. Write us, Bible for Today, Collingswood, New Jersey, or call us on the order phone, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Ask your bookstore for Defending the King James Bible and the Defined King James Bible, or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Dr. D.A. Waite, signing off and reminding you, you can have confidence in the King James Bible because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. Hope you'll tune in next week, the same time and same station, for another broadcast. We're going to continue about Dr. Scrivener, who is a combating school against the Westcott and Hort's type of false textual criticism. We're talking about this book, Guide to the Textual Criticism of the New Testament by Edward Miller, an associate and helper of Dean John William Burgon. You ought to get it. It's book number 743. It's reprinted by the Dean Burgon Society in recent times, the last few months. Originally the book 1885, 1886, an old book, but it's a summary you ought to get. Till next broadcast, same time, same station. So long. We now present the Bible for Today of the Air, read each week at the same time and over the same station, sponsored by the Bible for Today Incorporated and the Dean Burgon Society, with international studios at 900 Park Avenue, Collingswood, New Jersey. This is Dr. D.A. Waite, Director of the Bible for Today, speaking. Welcome to weekly broadcast number 843. 843 weeks of weekly broadcasting, standing together with the Dean Burgon Society in defense of traditional Bible texts, including the traditional Masoretic Hebrew Old Testament text, the traditional received Greek New Testament text, and the traditional English text, the King James Bible. We're building Bible confidence. Confidence in the King James Bible, because the King James Bible is the Bible for today.
The order phone number is 1-800-JOHN-10-9. For other things, please call us on a question and answer phone, 856-854-4452, or email bft@bibleforttoday.org. We'd like to hear from you. We'd like to get our book called Defending the King James Bible, now in its 8th printing, 350 pages, hardback edition. Why not ask your bookstore to get Defending the King James Bible, or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Then have you received your defined King James Bible, published for the Bible for Today? Uncommon words in the King James are defined accurately in the footnotes. It's deluxe, genuine leather, choice of 12-point large print, 10-point medium print, not another Bible like it in the world. Over 46,000 are in print and distributed worldwide. Why not order yourself a copy and one for your friends? The defined King James Bible. All right, we're also continuing now, as we have these past weeks, a guide to the textual criticism of the New Testament by Edward Miller and Associate Dean John William Burgon, written about 1885 in that era. And this was recently republished and reprinted by the Dean Burgon Society in a beautiful hardback edition. It's a wonderful book. You ought to get it. It's number 743. Number 743. Now, I'm against the textual criticism. I don't believe we need it any longer. I believe that Dean Burgon and others have solved the problems of textual criticism. We have a text that's been preserved by God, Hebrew text in the Old Testament that underlies our King James Bible, Greek text that underlies our King James Bible. And so the textual criticism is not what we need today. We need to follow what we have been given by the Lord and follow what the Lord has preserved for us. I believe very definitely God promised to preserve his Hebrew and Greek words. I believe he's fulfilled that promise in the Hebrew and Greek texts and words that underlie our King James Bible. And I believe the King James Bible is the only accurate translation of those proper preserved Hebrew and Greek words. But be that as it may, this is a history of textual criticism. It's chapter 3 of Edward Miller's book. And they talked about some of the early beginnings, and then the youth of this textual criticism, now the signs of maturity, other doctors widening the basis of it, and he gets into Dr. Frederick Scrivener. Last week we ended up with Dr. Scrivener. His labors in the area of textual criticism are well known from his admirable introduction to the science, a handbook which leaves hardly anything, if anything, to be desired. That's his plain introduction to the criticism of the New Testament, which we have in reprint form, and it's a good book, and Scrivener is on our side, not the other person's side. In fact, Dr. Scrivener was on the English Revised Version Committee himself. He fought back and forth with Dr. Hort and Dr. Westcott many, many hours in that debate, trying to get them to retain the traditional text readings in their new Greek text, but they refused. He was outvoted and outnumbered. Dr. Scribner's candor, says Brother Miller, and patient and conscientious consideration of every point that presents itself and of every opinion resting upon intelligence are conspicuous in all that he has written upon this subject. And his accuracy, a matter of extreme importance in these matters, stands at the very top of editorial and collateral and collational work. Let me continue. Let the truth be known, says the Dean of Chichester, that's Dean Burgon. C.F. Mathai and he, that is Dr. Scrivener, are the only two scholars who have collated any considerable number of sacred codices with the needful amount of accuracy. And a quote from Dean Burgon. Now, what they mean by that, collated, that is compared, every single word in the Greek manuscripts, between this manuscript and that manuscript, basing it on some standard, but collating it. And he's the only one, he and Mathai, C.F. Mathai, have done this. Let me continue. Mr. Miller says, in 1853, Dr. Scribner published a full and exact collation of about 20 Greek manuscripts of the Holy Gospels. In his introduction, he said this, now, by the way, this was in 1853. Now, if you recall, these other people that were in the extreme textual position, both Westcott and Hort and Lachman and Tichendorf and Tregelis, they died in about 1875. And here, Dr. Scribner was in the process and had made his book, very good book, well before that, 1853. Yes, these men died in 1875, 1873, along in that line, both Lachman and Tregelis. But he made this, as I said, in 1853. The following pages comprise a humble yet earnest attempt to revive among the countrymen of Bentley and Mill some interest in a branch of biblical learning which for upwards of a century we have tacitly abandoned to continental scholars. Now that's what has been mentioned, and is a quotation from this book. That's what he wanted to do. The continental scholars, that means those over in Germany. You see, he was writing from England, Dr. Scribner was, and he wanted to straighten things out because of the mess that the continental scholars had made. And the continental scholars include Griesbach, Ed Lachman, and Tichendorf, and Tregelis. These are the ones that he's talking about without naming them. Let me continue. Mr. Miller says, the success of this attempt, if limited to these earlier days of Dr. Scribner's influence, to comparatively a small band of scholars, nevertheless has been conspicuous. This work was followed in 1859 by, quote, an exact transcript of the Codex Augensius, to which is added a full collation of 50 manuscripts. Now, to both of these works, valuable introductions are prefixed, explanatory of the principles of the science and containing discussions upon controversial questions such as whether there are families of manuscripts, and against the partial use of only a few authorities as advocated by Lachman and Tregelis. Let me just pause right there, simply say this. He's talking now about controversial questions, such as whether there are families of manuscripts. Dr. Scribner and Dean Burgon and Edward Miller, all of them, denied that there were such things as families. But these other men, Griesbach, Lachman, Tichendorf, Tregelis, these men claimed that there were families. And one of them had three families, the other one had four families. One of them had two families. Westcott and Hort had four families. In other words, they said the families, the Caesarean, the Alexandrian, the ones that came from the Text Receptus, which they say were the Byzantine, and the Western, all these four families Westcott and Hort came up with, but some of them came up with just two families, another man came up with three families. But Dean Burgon, Edward Miller, and Dr. Scribner do not believe that there were such things as families. In fact, as I said before in the broadcast, Dean Burgon simply says that manuscripts are like orphan children. There's no proof, except for one or two, no proof whatever that one was taken from another. It's like going into a graveyard with all unmarked graves. And you can't prove that this one was related to this one, related to this one. They're all unmarked. They're simply graves put in there. And this is what the manuscripts are. Secondly, he was against, Dr. Scribner was against, the partial use of only a few authorities as advocated by Lachman and Tregelis. Partial use of just a few. Now, granted, you can't take all, but you can have a representative, certainly, and not just a few. Let me continue. Miller says, in 1864, he, that is, Dr. Scribner, published a full collation of the Codex Sinaiticus. It's the Sinai manuscript that was discovered by Tichendorf in Mount Catherine's convent on Mount Sinai. He published this full collation with corrections of errata, or errors, in Tichendorf's edition of the same manuscript. And in the same year, that is, in 1864, Dr. Scribner edited for the University of Cambridge a handsome volume containing the great Cambridge manuscript D. Such with his plain introduction already noticed, have been the chief, but by no means his only works. The line taken by Dr. Scrivener has uniformly been that all evidence must be employed in comparative or textual criticism. Let me just pause right there. All evidence. That's what Dean Bergon has said. That's what our position is. You must have all evidence. You can't truncate or shorten the evidence. You can't apocryphate it or make it small. You have to deal with all of it. That's the problem with the so-called Westcott and Hort type of text. That's the problem with the Nestle-Aland Greek New Testament. That's the problem with the United Bible Society text. That's the problem with the so-called majority texts of Hodges and Farstad or Pierpont and Robinson. These are not taking into consideration all the evidence. That's what Dean Bergon advocated completely. That means all the manuscripts, first of all, whether the manuscripts be the uncials or capital letter manuscripts, the curses or flowing hand manuscripts, or the lectionaries, which were scriptures read in the churches. All these manuscripts must be taken, or also the papyri, the papyrus manuscripts. These four classes of manuscripts must be looked at. The uncials, the cursives, the papyri, and the lectionaries. Then, on top of that, you must look at all of the early versions, the early translations of the scripture. The earlier the better. What text did they use in the Greek New Testament to make their translations? Those early versions, 10 or 11 versions that should be looked at. And then in the sixth place, there must be a picture and a look at the early church fathers or early church leaders that wrote letters concerning the Bible and either made allusions or direct quotations from Scripture. And Dean Bergon has done that. Some 86,000 quotations he's put in his indexes, 16 folio, large, huge folio volumes in the British Museum. And how did these church fathers, these early church leaders, when either defending or talking about the scriptures, the New Testament, what version, what word, what Greek text did they have in their hands? Those are very important things. So these are all the types of evidence. And Dean Bergon wanted every single type of evidence brought in. That's what Dr. Scrivener is saying here, that we must have the most, all evidence must be employed in comparative or textual criticism. Let me continue. Yet not all indiscriminately, but each must be assigned its proper value. Thus, he by no means accedes to the proposal of neglecting the received text. But, on the other hand, he has ever admitted that revision is required and has been ready to submit to the clear verdict of evidence. Let me just pause right here. Well, Dean Bergon said also that there is need for small amounts of revision in the Textus Receptus that underlies our King James Bible. But, he said, you've got to do it accurately. You have to do it properly. And he listed some 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 different things that had to be done before the thing could be completely revised. And he says that the time is not ripe for that. We don't have the men to do it. We don't have the materials to do it. We cannot do it properly. And so the position of our Dean Bergon Society is to leave it as it is. To leave the Textus Receptus that underlies our King James Bible exactly as it is, not to change it or alter it, and keep it as is, because it cannot be done right. A revision was not done right from the Lachman text in translation. It wasn't done right by Griesbach's text. It was not done right by Tregelis. It was not done right by Tischendorf. Certainly was not done right by the Westcott and Hort Greek text. And it wasn't done right by the majority text of Robinson and Pierpont or Hodges and Farstad. No. Because just leave it alone. That's what Dean Bergon would say, as he said in his books. To continue, the revision is required and has been already to admit the clear verdict of evidence. He would proceed, as Dr. Scribner, with far-sighted and wide-viewed caution, and would urge that everything possible should be done to make all documents of whatever sort to minister in their several places to well-pondered conclusions. Paragraph number 2 now in this story about the Dr. Scribner's contribution says this: of about the same age as Dr. Scribner, but in the enjoyment of better health, the Dean of Chichester, and he's going to talk now about Dean John William Burgon, the Dean of Chichester is a redoubtable champion upon the same side. His first book in this department was A Vindication of the Last 12 Verses of Mark's Gospel, published in 1871. I remember the one by Dr. Scribner was published in 1853, and then again 1859 he published something else. And here Dr. Dean Burgon, on the same side as Dr. Scribner, published in 1871 The Last 12 Verses of Mark. We have reprinted this. The Dean Burgon Society has reprinted this valuable book. Over 350 pages. It's a hardback edition. You should get this book. It's number 1139. A DBS or BFD number 1139. The Last 12 Verses of Mark. An excellent, excellent book that you should get. If in 1871, in which, according to the award of the first living judge, he has thrown a stream of light a controversy, nor does the joyous tone of his book misbecome one who is conscious of having triumphantly maintained a cause which is very precious to him. Now, this is a quotation from the Outline of Textual Criticism by C.E. Hammond, and he quoted that concerning Dean Burgon, a very fine and a very, very good quotation. Indeed, this, I believe, was now such a even an unfavorable judge as Mr. Hammond. Now, wait a minute, I guess this wasn't Mr. Hammond. This possibly was the quotation from Dr. Scribner himself. Then Edmund Miller continues, even so unfavorable a judge as Mr. Hammond admits the cogency and success of his arguments. Now, there is the quotation that we have from there. The other is the advocate of Dr. Scribner, but here's Hammond. Even though he doesn't agree with it, he admits the cogency and success of his arguments. In other words, the Last 12 Verses of Mark did a good job, even from a critic of Dean Burgon. Let me continue. We're on page number 33, talking about A Guide to the Textual Criticism of the New Testament. It's a history of textual criticism. As I say, I'm opposed to the general picture of it. It's needful, has been needful, but we've got to drop it and continue on with what we're doing. But let me continue. Another, marked with the natural impetuosity of Dean Burgon's controversial style, but bristling with learning, and built upon remarkably strong and detailed foundations, which, as it appears, many of his opponents have not the patience to examine accurately, is the Revision Revised. So here's another one. Here's another document that he's written, and we've got that thing published as well. It's been reprinted, hardback edition, beautiful book, over 654 pages, tremendous book. He says it's a republication of articles in the Quarterly Review, with additions chiefly upon the disputed text of the first epistle of Timothy. So it's 1 Timothy 3:16 and so on. But these two books, the first two books that Dean Burgon has written, are reprinted. You ought to get them. That's number 611, Revision Revised, number 611. Now, the other one, The Last 12 Verses of Mark, number 1139, do you have them? Don't listen to the people who say the Westcott and Hort theories and text is the correct text and are the correct theories. They're not the correct theories at all. When they hold up the new versions, for example, or the Westcott and Hort Greek text, or the Nestle Island text, or the United Bible Society text of Mark 16:9-20, and say, oh, these verses should not be included. That's what they're saying, they should not be included. Read this Last 12 Verses of Mark book by Dean Burgon. he'll show very clearly that these are valid verses that should never be destroyed, never be doubted by a footnote saying that the B and Aleph, the Vatican Sinai manuscript, leave them out. They're practically the only ones that do leave them out. But over 18 other uncials have the Mark 16, 9 to 20. About 600 cursives have them. All the lectionaries of the East, the 10 early versions have them. 19 early church fathers made allusion to and reference to them. There's no question but their authenticity. So the last four verses of my, and then if you're interested further in pursuing this, if you have any idea of finding out the truth, as I pursued the truth, I was taught Westcott and Hort's Greek text at Dallas Theological Seminary while Dr. Schaefer was still the president, the founder, still living. He died in the summer of 1952. Our class graduated before his death. And so I've been taught Westcott and Hort. And for the next 20 or 25 years, I was in the dark. Until 1971 or thereabouts, when I realized that I had been bamboozled. I had been lied to by Dallas Theological Seminary teachers that were pushing Westcott and Hort's text. And they'd never told us the other side. They never told us there was a Textus Receptus that underlies the King James Bible. All the teachers wanted us to do, although they used the King James, they wanted us to use the new, or not the new, but the American Standard Version of 1901, because it was favorable to their Greek text, the Westcott and Hort text. And so that was what I was taught. I had to fight this thing. But the Revision Revised and Dean John William Burgon and his writings convinced me of the truth of that position. To throw away the Westcott and Hort type of text, Nestle Island and United Bible Society, that text based upon B and Aleph, the most scurrilous manuscripts that ever saw the light of day, as Dean Burgon says, B and Aleph, Vatican and Sinai. They're not the best. They may be the oldest from the standpoint of the material on which they're written, but they're loaded with heresies, loaded with the Gnostic heresies of the day, and cannot be trusted at all. So this Revision Revised, you know what it does? It does four things. Number one, it criticizes and condemns the text, the Greek text of Westcott and Hort. Number two, it criticizes the actual theories behind that text. Number three, that was number two. Number three, it criticizes the English Revised Version from which that was taken. And number four, it exalts the Textus Receptus and the King James Bible itself. So these are the things of the Revision Revised, and you should listen to them, you should take charge of them, and you should do this, and get this book, number 611, from the Bible for Today of the Dean Burgon Society. And we continue. Besides these books, the Dean is constantly at work, and that's Dean Burgon, and his beliefs, and he was still living while this was written, 1885, 1886, Dean Burgon died 1888. So, says he's still constantly at work and is believed to have copious materials for future publication, and his letters from Rome, that's in 1862, and sundry letters from time to time in the Guardian newspaper, as well as contributions to editions of Dr. Scribner's Plain Introduction, to the last of which he has added particulars of 374 manuscripts previously unknown to the world of letters, are results of toil which has been continued for many years. So Dean Burgon was a friend and a helper of Dr. Scribner, and Edward Miller was the assistant of Dean Burgon and his understudy, as it were. Let me continue. Miller says, Dean Burgon has incurred much misrepresentation. Let me just pause right there. That certainly is true. Much misrepresentation. They've misrepresented him. They've said that he has a bad attitude. He flaunts over it. My friend, I've read him. You should read him. It's a thrill to read him. He's strong. He has good English language. He has proper respect for his time, but he's misrepresented, and people did not give him a fair hearing when he wrote these books, 1871, which was the last 12 verses of Mark, 1881, which was the Revision Revised, 1883, I guess it was, Revision Revised, They completely misunderstood him, misrepresented him, and they misrepresent him today. They just discount him as some old fool of some kind. Absolutely false. Misrepresented Dean Burgum. Let me continue. He does not maintain the faultlessness of the received text. He is not a devoted adherent of the Alexandrian Greek. See, now, that's true. He did not believe that it was faultless, the text that underlies our King James Bible. But on the other hand, he doesn't go along with the Codex Alexandrinus, the Alexandrian text. He does not simply count his authorities or follow the largest number, irrespective of their weight and value, but he urges that all of them should be taken into account. And that's true. Now notice, he believes it should be correct that the text was referenced in a few places, but as I said before in the broadcast, he says you've got to do it right. And to do it right, he lists these things in the Revision Revised that are necessary before a major revision of the Text Receptus can be undertaken. And he says the time is not ripe for that to be done. We don't have the Englishmen to do it. And we don't have the additions to do it of the Church Fathers and so on. He lists these things. If you're interested in the things he would require, we've reprinted this. We've reprinted a book that I wrote called Dean Burgum's Revision. When would Dean Burgum revise? How and when would Dean Burgum revise? It's available. You can get it. And it gives you the lists of things. And when you finish reading his requirements for revision, you can see that even today it's much less ripe for revision than it was when Dean Burgum lived in 1883 and wrote Revision Revised. Let me continue. He says, quote, this is from the Revision Revised, page 518, quote, that the truth of the text of Scripture is to be elicited exclusively from the consentient testimony of the largest number of the best copies, fathers, versions, end of quote. That's what his position is, and that's what we believe as well. Well, time's up for now. Remember the words of our Lord Jesus Christ in John 10:9. He said, I am the door. By me, if any man have any, shall be saved, and shall go in and out and find pasture. Write us. Bible for Today, Collingswood, New Jersey. Call us on the order phone, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Ask your bookstore for Defending the King James Bible and the Defined King James Bible, or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Dr. D.A. Reid is here, and we're signing off and reminding you can have confidence in the King James Bible because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. We hope you will stay tuned to our next broadcast. It will be coming up, and we want to continue this course of action, The Guide to Textual Criticism. It's a new reprint of the Dean Burgum Society hardback edition. It's number 743. You ought to call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9 and get your copy of this book. It's a history of textual criticism, and it comes down on the right side, not the wrong side, not the Westcott and Hort side of the issue. It's something that we've got to understand, and we've got to defend, as we defend on this broadcast, the text that underlies our King James Bible, Hebrew and Greek, as well as our King James Bible itself. We stand for it. We want you to stay tuned. We'll see you same time, same station, next broadcast, next week. Until then, so long. We now present the Bible for Today of the Air, heard each week at the same time and over the same station, sponsored by the Bible for Today Incorporated and the Dean Burgum Society, with international studios at 900 Park Avenue, Collingswood, New Jersey. This is Dr. D.A. Waite, director of the Bible for Today, speaking. Welcome to weekly broadcast number 844. 844 weeks of weekly broadcasting, standing together with the Dean Burgum Society in defense of traditional Bible texts, including the traditional Masoretic Hebrew Old Testament text, the traditional received Greek New Testament text, and the traditional English text, the King James Bible. We're building Bible confidence. Confidence in the King James Bible because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. The order phone number is 1-800-JOHN-10-9. For other things, please call us on our question and answer phone, 856-854-4452, or email bft@bibleforToday.org. We'd love to hear from you. We
We'd like you to get our book called Defending the King James Bible. Now in its eighth printing, 350 pages, hardback edition, why not ask your bookstore to get Defending the King James Bible, or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Then have you ordered your Defined King James Bible, published for the Bible for today? Uncommon words in the King James are defined accurately in the footnotes. Not another Bible like it in the world. It's deluxe, genuine leather, choice of 12-point large print, 10-point medium print. Over 46,000 are in print and distributed worldwide. Why not order yourself a copy and one for your friends, the Defined King James Bible? Just call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. We'll tell you how to get it. All right, we're continuing to discuss the Guide to the Textual Criticism of the New Testament by Edward Miller, Associate Dean John William Burgon. It's a hardback edition reprint. Originally came out about 1885, 1886, and it's been reprinted just recently by the Dean Burgon Society. Beautiful yellow and red cover. It's hardback edition. It's number 743. You should get a copy of this. It's not a very large book. It's a very small book, 145, 150 pages in all. We don't go along with much of the textual criticism. We believe that it's been solved, it's been settled. We don't go along with the Westcott and Hort type of thing. But Edward Miller goes historically into the issues involving these so-called textual critics. And we're in Chapter 3, talking about the more mature textual criticism. He's outlined the extreme textualism of Griesbach and Lachmann and Tischendorf and Tregelis and Westcott and Hort. Now he's taken up Dr. Scrivener, who's more conservative, and then Dean John William Burgon. Dean Burgon says we have to look at the largest number of the best copies, best church fathers will take quotations, and best versions or early translations. We're on page 34 of the book. Get it and follow along with us. That is the truth which enjoys the earliest. Here's what Dean Burgon says. It must enjoy the earliest, the fullest, the widest, and most respectable, and above all things, the most varied attestation. That all the existing copies must be assembled and accurately collated, the versions edited, the fathers, that is, these church fathers, indexed, and before a revision of the Greek text can be successfully accomplished. Let me just pause right there and quote from Dean Burgon. Now, these things have not been done. Even in Dean Burgon's day, 1883, when he wrote the Revision Revised, he said, I look around and I can't find Englishmen that would do the job and do it right. But notice, he believes before a major revision of the text of Recepi, he believes there are a few things, odds and ends, that should be corrected. But he said, before that can be done, you have to have all existing copies assembled and accurately collated. Now, stop right there. Accurately collated, that is, compared one with the other to know exactly the variations from a common standard. That hasn't been done. That will not be done. Do you know how many manuscripts, either complete or fragments, there are? There's over 5,255 as of 1967. There may be 100 or so more added to that since then. But Kurt Arland counted 5,255. Do you believe that all those should be and can be collated by anyone? Dean Burgon said it must be done. And then the versions edited. That means all these ancient versions that have come out, the translations from the text, edited again. Now, who's done that? And then the fathers, the early church fathers, indexed. And, of course, he's gotten indexed. 86,000 quotations or allusions to the Bible by these early church writers, the fathers. He's indexed them. But where are they published? They're in the British Museum, but they're color-coded, and the color coding of it and the indications of the color must be there. And how are you going to take a picture of them? You have to have colored film, and now the British Museum won't let anybody take it but they themselves, and they'll charge an arm and a leg for the pictures. And then after you get the pictures of the father's indexing and that he's done, they're color-coded. That's the word I was looking for, color-coded. After you get the colored pictures and all, you have to have the church fathers' editions that Dean Burgon was alluding to, because that's where the pages are where the church father says what he says. So it's virtually impossible to get all these church fathers, even though he has indexed them with the help of many, many helpers while he was still living. Now, of course, I realize Dr. Jack Mormon, one of our missionaries that we support, our Bible for the Baptist Church supports in London, England, has written a book on the early church fathers. He's done an excellent job from current quotations on that same thing. But Dean Burgon says all the words must be edited afresh. All the manuscripts collated and compared. All the church fathers indexed before a revision of the Greek can be successfully published. And then he says that evidence and examination prove convincingly that the Vatican B and the Sinaitic Aleph manuscripts exhibit really bad instead of good texts. Now that's another conclusion of Dean Burgon. And that all must be rested upon definite external attestation, not upon the shifting sands of conjecture, opinion, taste, and other internal sources of inference. End of quote. Here, Dean Burgon, these are all quotations from Dean Burgon's Revision Revised, as to how this should be done. And as I said before, number 804, BFT number 804, I've assembled all the quotations from the Revision Revised. How and when would Dean Burgon revise? How would Dean Burgon revise? That's the title of this booklet. If you're interested in getting it, call us and we'll let you know how to get it at 1-800-JOHN-10. How and when would Dean Burgon revise? Revise not only the text for Septus, but revise the King James Bible. And he says you can't change the King James Bible until you've adequately and accurately revised the Greek text that underlies it in the New Testament. He says the Old Testament text should not be tinkered with. It should not be changed. He was solid on that, indeed. And we continue, Edward Miller says, it should be added that Dean Burgon surpasses everyone in acquaintance with patristic evidence of readings. The patristic, the church fathers, the evidence of the readings of the early church leaders, the bishops, the ones that wrote and quoted or alluded to Scripture. He surpasses everyone. And that is true. And you know, the present people, the Westcott and Hort people, the Nestle Allen people in the Greek text, the United Bible Society people, even the majority text of Hodges and Fosstad or Robinson and Pierpont, these people do not adequately quote and allude to the church fathers as Dean Burgon believes we should. Some of them don't even have any quotations or allusions from the church fathers. Yes, he believed this was a tremendous source of evidence for the proper Greek New Testament readings. He says because they're dated people. You can date the church fathers. You know when they lived. And manuscripts have no date. You don't know when they wrote these manuscripts. They're just undated. But the church fathers' allusions and quotations from their Greek text that they held in their hands, they had dates. And you can tell exactly what word they were quoting from in any particular instance. Let's leave Dean Burgon and go to paragraph 3 in this signs of coming maturity in this idea of the history of textual criticism. Another learned maintainer of this view of the controversy is Canon Cook. Canon Cook, the editor-in-chief of the Speaker's Commentary. His controversy with the Bishop of Durham upon the rendering of the last petition of the Lord's Prayer, on which his last and longest letter has maintained as yet unanswered, and his treatise upon the revised version of the first three Gospels, have been important contributions to the literature of this subject. So here's Canon Cook, another man that is against the so-called wild criticism, textual criticism of Westcott and Hort and others. Let me continue. Miller says, calm, moderate, weighty in argument, learned, persuasive, he has controverted the main position of the opposed school in the latter of these two works with great cogency, great meaning and understanding, in other words. He maintains that, as Canon Cook maintains, that the Vatican B and Sinaitic Aleph codices have been unduly exalted, that the Alexandrian, or A, which in the Gospels fairly represents the text used by Chrysostom and his great contemporaries, is superior to them. And then it spells right there. Canon Cook. Manuscript A, the Alexandrian text, Alexandrinus, in the Gospels at least, is very close to the text of Receptus and certainly superior to B and Aleph and contradicts B and Aleph in many places. Let me continue. That the former two, that is B and Aleph, Vatican and Sinai, were probably written under the direction of Eusebius, and that the theories and arguments of Drs. Westcott and Hort are destitute of solid foundation. I like to hear that. The arguments and theories of Drs. Westcott and Hort are destitute of solid foundation. This is what Dean Burgon has written in his book, Revision Revised. You want to get that book, BFT or DBS number 611. Number 611. Carlos will tell you how to get your copy of that. Over 594, almost 600 pages, hardback edition. We've reprinted it. And as I said before on the broadcast last week, the Revision Revised by Dean John William Burgon does four things. Number one, it refutes the text of the New Testament Greek text of Westcott and Hort. Number two, it refutes the theory, the false theory behind that Greek text. Number three, it refutes the English Revised Version of 1881. Number four, it exalts the Authorized Version, the King James Bible. And so these are the four things that Revision Revised does. And so the theories and arguments of Westcott and Hort, destitute of solid foundation. And Dean Burgon takes this up in the Revision Revised as well. Let me continue. Edward Miller says also, those eminent scholars, Bishops Christopher and Charles Wordsworth, par nobili fratrum, and nobility, noble of brotherhood, the loss of the first of whom we are now deploring, in other words, Bishops Christopher, have spoken upon the same side, that is the same side of Dean Burgon and Canon Cook and Dr. Scrivener, in charges delivered to the clergy of their diocese, depreciating, amongst other things, too much confidence in manuscripts, unquote. He's talking about these favorite manuscripts of B and Aleph, which these other false, extreme textualists have put their trust in and depended upon almost exclusively, namely Griesbach, Lachmann, Tischendorf, Tregellis, Westcott and Hort, and favorite manuscripts. And these men, Bishop Christopher and Charles Wordsworth, certainly say there's too much confidence in certain favorite manuscripts, which Dean Burgon says are probably the worst. Not sure, shall be favored, they're probably the worst. We continue, Edward Miller says, nor is this contention without contemporary support upon the continent. Now that's over in, he's in England, he's writing from England, and the continent over in Europe. In 1862, Dr. J.G. Reiche, R-E-I-C-H-E, warned scholars against Lachmann. Now that Lachmann, you remember, is a German hard critic, unbeliever, a rationalist, that propounded false theories. The dangerous principles by Lachmann is what he says. He argued against the dangerous principles introduced by Lachmann and the almost superstitious veneration that was then paid to Lachmann's text. Here again is veneration. This is worship. As I said before when I mentioned this, worship of B and Aleph, the Vatican Sinai, James White in the debate that I had with him 3 hours one time on the radio, he said, oh, this is terrible. We should not say we worship. This is too strong. Why, here again, superstitious veneration. Westcott and Hort paid and others paid to B and Aleph, and this man says that there's entirely too much superstitious veneration paid to the Lachmann's text, which is founded on B and Aleph again. Let me continue, Mr. Miller says, and especially he spoke against the practice introduced by that learned scholar of consulting only a few witnesses. Now, there's your B and Aleph witnesses. That's what you have, a small, tiny stream of witnesses, B and Aleph and those that agree with B and Aleph, Vatican and Sinai. And then he says, observing especially that several of the versions are older than any manuscripts. End of quote. Let me just pause right there. If you're looking for ancient witnesses, if you're saying that age is important,
if you're saying we've got to go back to B and Aleph because of the oldest, perhaps, manuscripts that we have, maybe the 4th century, 375, 350 A.D., nobody knows exactly the date. If you're saying that you've got to go back to early manuscripts because they're closer to the originals, there are other evidences, other versions, other quotations of the early church fathers earlier than any manuscripts. That's where they should go back to, and that's what Dean Burgon has done with his last 12 verses of Mark. If you're interested in defending Mark 16:9-20, you must get Dean Burgon's book. We reprinted it, hardback edition, Dean Burgon Society. We have it here. Call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. We'll tell you how to get it. 350 pages, hardback edition it is. And he will show you that Mark 16:9-20 must be accepted, not because B and Aleph have thrown them out, these sections here, Mark 16:9-20, these last 12 verses of Mark, not because Dean Burgon, manuscripts B and Aleph have thrown them out, but they're to be accepted because ancient uncials that precede and are before these B and Aleph, or at least have them in, and 600 cursors have them in, and early versions have them, these verses in, and the quotations of the early church fathers or allusions have them in, because of the evidence. And many of these versions and many of these quotations of the early church fathers are before and predate B and Aleph, who leave them out. So this is a very important consideration. Several of the versions are older than any manuscripts. Let me continue talking about this man, Dr. J.G. Reisch. In 1860, writing from Leiden, A. Kunin and C.G. Cobit, in the preface, now here's two other men, preface to an edition of the Vatican Codex, protested against the notion that because that this was the oldest manuscript, it therefore possessed an authority paramount to that of all others. On the contrary, they asserted, these two men now, proving the assertion with a copious array of evidence that, quote, there is no kind of error that is not frequently found in that manuscript as in all the rest. Talking about Vatican Codex B. Continuing, Edward Miller says also, at the beginning of 1884, Dr. J.H.A. Michelson, in the Theologus Tischschrift, it's a German word, a monthly magazine published at Leiden, submitted the text of B and Aleph, that's Vatican and Vatican Sinai, to a vigorous examination. From internal proofs, such as glosses introduced from other passages, glosses meaning footnotes that are inserted into the text that are not true, readings plainly bad where better exist, and omissions of verses and paragraphs, all copiously illustrated, he drew the conclusion that the so-called neutral text is not so good as the advocates of it claim, and directed attention to the dangerous traversing of the principle quod semper, quod ubique, quod ab omnibus, which is involved in the acceptance of the form of that form of text. Now, that which is faithful, that which is everywhere, and that which is from all. That's what that word means, and it's a Latin term, if I translate it correctly, which is involved in the acceptance of that form of the text. So we've got to be careful. It's not neutral, and these men have said that it was not neutral either. Let's continue. Edward Miller says, besides these, we may reckon the strong sentiment prevailing in the Roman branch of the church. A verse alone, the editor of B, or the Vatican, now no more, held no such opinions as those of extreme textualism. Now, see, that's what we're talking about. Griesbach was an extreme textualist. Lachmann was an extreme textualist. The Tregellis was an extreme textualist. Tischendorf was an extreme textualist. Westcott was an extreme textualist. Hort was an extreme textualist. And he says, These views
held no such opinions as those of extreme textualism, that is, this Bertillon, who was in the Roman Catholic Church, Sarioni of Milan, and a learned writer in the Dublin Review, seem to represent what is held in these quarters. And the Abbe Martin of Paris, in his elaborate fascicles, whatever that means, maintains the same side of the controversy. In other words, these are even from the churches of Roman Catholic scholars have questioned the authenticity and the veracity of Codex B, the Vatican Codex. Continuing, Miller says, it will be seen from this sketch that so far from questions being already settled amongst the learned and ripe for a general decision, which would enjoy universal assent, two rival schools are now contending for the ascendancy. Notice, two rival schools. That's well put. And these two rival schools are going to be talked about in this book by Miller. And the next chapter, chapter 4, is going to be talking about the school of extreme textualism, the theory of Westcott and Hort explained and refuted. That's very important indeed. So two rival schools. Now, Dean Burgon said of these two rival schools, they cannot be compromised and cannot be dovetailed together. There's no compromise. There's no middle ground that these two rival schools can take. Either one is true and the other false, or the other is true and the other is false. There can be no compromises, no adequate explanations to solve both of them and agree together as sort of a meshing of them. You cannot have no middle ground. Let me continue. Edward Miller says, the two rival schools, the one of German origin, is strongly and ably maintained in England and reckons large support amongst biblical scholars. Now, he's writing now in 1885, 1886. The other rival school, headed by the first textual critic of the day and earnestly advocated by accomplished theologians. Now, this textual critic of the day is Dr. Scrivener and, of course, certainly Dean Burgon, and earnestly advocated by accomplished theologians, counts also among its adherents Roman Catholics in England and on the continent, that is, in Europe, including experts in Italy and elsewhere. Therefore, careful and respectful consideration is further necessary in order that after contrasting and weighing the several characteristics of both schools, both of these rival schools, we may know from solid considerations which of the two to follow. Which of the two schools to follow? Now, it's a sad thing, indeed, that the famous four fundamentalist friends that are in the world today, in this country, in the United States of America today, it's sad indeed that these four famous fundamentalist schools advocate the wrong rival school. It's sad that Bob Jones University, Detroit Baptist Seminary, Calvary Baptist Seminary, Central Baptist Seminary are the leaders in polluting the entire modern stream of preachers and pastors in the churches today and on the mission fields today. It's sad that they've come down on the wrong side of the rival school, that they have taken the position of the extreme textualists of the apostates Griesbach, apostates Lachmann, all these apostates Tischendorf, and apostates Westcott and Hort, and have taken the wrong turn in what our Bible should be. It's a sad thing. That's why our Bible for Today ministry, our Dean Burgon Society ministry, is arguing against this falseness and trying to bring sense into the nonsense of these schools regarding to which text and which type of textual theory are you to take and to agree with, Westcott and Hort's or Dean Burgon's and Dr. Scrivener's and Edward Miller's and others. Well, we come now to chapter 4 of this book. We're talking about the guide to the textual criticism of the New Testament, beautifully reprinted, 1885-1886, reprint by the Dean Burgon Society. Edward Miller is the author. He's an associate of Dean John William Burgon. We're now in chapter 4, and we're on page number 38. You ought to get a copy of this. It's number 743. Call us. We'll tell you how to get your copies. Hardback edition. Beautiful yellow and red and black cover. It's a striking book. You need to get it to review some of these things. All right, chapter 4. The School of Extreme Textualism. The theory of Westcott and Hort explained and refuted. We not only explain it, but Edward Miller refutes it. He begins by saying this. A new period began in 1831. Now he's talking about a new period. Not that of Griesbach and Lachmann and Tischendorf and Pergellis and Westcott and Hort, but a new period. Well, Westcott and Hort actually were the people in the new period. A new period began. He's talking about these two rival schools. When for the first time a text was constructed directly from the ancient documents without the intervention of any printed edition, and when the first systematic attempt was made to substitute scientific method for arbitrary choice in the discrimination of various readings. Now that's Westcott and Hort in their introduction, page 13. Now that's what they did. That's what Westcott and Hort did in this false text. They began it in 1831. They finished it in 1881 and got the text to arrive. It's a terrible thing. Actually, they began working on it in 1850. 30 years it took them to get that text. But this is what they did. They threw out the scientific method for an arbitrary choice in the discrimination of various readings. We continue. Edward Miller says, so the leading masters in the first of the rival schools attribute its foundation to Lachmann. Now, this is where they attribute the foundation, a false foundation of Lachmann. It began with Lachmann's principles, and after many years have brought them to their natural and extreme development in the elaborate system which they have constructed, and which is in the main accepted and upheld by other adherents of this school. In other words, Westcott and Hort, apostates as they were the founders of this false rival school. We're going to have to stop here. Time's up for now. Remember the words of our Lord Jesus Christ in John 10:9. He said, I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out and find pasture. Write us. Bible for Today, Collinswood, New Jersey. Call us on the order phone, 1-800-JOHN-10-9. Ask your bookstore for Defending the King James Bible and the Defined King James Bible, or call us at 1-800-JOHN-10-9. We'll tell you how to get them. Dr. D.A. Waite signing off and reminding you, you can have confidence in the King James Bible because the King James Bible is the Bible for today. We're going to continue this study, chapter 4 of this excellent book, A Guide to the Textual Criticism of the New Testament by Edward Miller, a pupil and a guide and a helper of Dean John William Burgon. Chapter 4, dealing with the school of extreme textualism, discussing the theory of Westcott and Hort, explaining it, and refuting it. This is what we need in the day in which we live. Too many versions are based on the false text of Westcott and Hort. Stay tuned. We'll see you next week, same time, same station. Until then, so long.